part of any book or anything. It's just mm-hmm. just background, how personally. This is side number two of tape number one, interview with David B. Putnam, December 28th, 1977. Time is flown. We're thinking about lunch. It's a quarter to three.
Two.
I'm on Pacific time here.
Well,
I have quarter to two.
The place stops serving it. Two, so maybe 2:30.
I think if you want to take another few minutes, right. then we should go eat lunch.
All right, I'm going to. Most of that isn't on tape that we did. We left off there. Okay, your mother and father really had quite a really great thing going for them in Rye. Your father was a successful publisher. Publishing books for adventurers and for people who were luminaries of the day. The house was a constant string of guests who were, like you say, opera singers and famous pianists and writers, authors, poets.
Explorers, everything.
Explorers. And your mother was a gracious and obviously enjoyed the entertaining. Your father was being successful in his publishing business. And at least as far as you were aware, as a child of 15 or 16 at the time, there was really no great conflicts going on.
None that I suspected or knew about.
But what goes on between two people, I guess, is between two people.
They were pretty discreet folks, I guess.
Now, your brother George... was rather quiet.
He was what I would call a loner. He didn't care about people or doing anything else. And of course, at that time, he was just a little boy.
Guess he would only have been 6 or 7 or
yeah.
8 at the time.
Yeah.
And while you were 15, 16, or 17. Mm-hmm. Now, you, did your father show any particular, as fathers are wont to do, have a favorite child, like perhaps?
Well, I don't think you can have a favorite child when there's 10 years difference, really. Certainly he had as much affection for the little fellow as he did for me, but when expeditions came along, you couldn't take a 7 or 10 year old. And I think there may have been some resentment on my brother's part as we grew up that I was an international celebrity as the youngest member of the Explorers Club and an author and all that sort of thing. And consequently, we've never been close at all. As a matter of fact, for many years, George resented not only us, but the family and the way we lived, and he was... almost communistic in his thinking. That we shouldn't have what we had, and he was quite a radical in school, and he never stayed in school very long.
So your relationship with your brother was, there was 10 year difference.
Minimal.
So there was a minimal relationship.
Right, and then of course when I started these expeditions, I did it continuously for
quite a
few years.
Home.
So I wasn't there, I never saw him at all.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that explains why David doesn't know about polio.
No, the polio thing would have happened when we were living in Rye. I remember vaguely his being threatened with something and being sick and maybe having a touch of polio or something that they thought was polio. I know that he was sick and that they were awfully worried about him, but the details just don't come back to me.
Is he crippled at all?
No, hell no.
No.
He's in better shape than I am.
That isn't possible.
Oh, yes, he is. No, he's in far better shape than I am.
Well, now, then, on the surface at least, there was really no reason for your mother and father's, there was no obvious surface reason for your mother and father's discord, which led to the divorce.
Well, if we're supposed to take sides, I think that she would be a lot more at fault than he was. This is between you and me. Because I think she may have been playing games with Frank Upton when she was accusing my dad of playing games with Amelia. It was about that same period. As far as I'm concerned, you could flip a coin, and as far as I'm concerned, I don't care either way.
They just
I have no recollections of either one being right or wrong as far as a divorce is concerned.
Do you remember that if your father, did he ever state to you that he didn't want the divorce? Or did he just accept the fact that she was going to go to Reno and get a divorce and that was...
I don't think I ever had an explanation from either one of them. My mother may have made some remarks about Amelia.
She found your father and Amelia in bed at the house in Rye.
Maybe so. And
it isn't important.
I would doubt that very much because I don't think Amelia would have had that kind of a doing in our house. If they'd had it, it wouldn't have been at our home. I don't believe that at all. I think that's probably strictly imaginary on my mother's part because it sounds good today.
And you feel that her mother,
her mind is that way. It's like her going to the Arctic when she didn't go to the Arctic. It makes it pretty concrete and specific to say, well, I caught them in bed and that's why I got a divorce. I don't believe it.
And probably then, is this fair to say that or it's not fair to say because we don't know the answer. And I'm just trying to get an impression that your mother was independent of nature and felt a little jealous of your father's being the limelight with the luminaries that were visiting your home.
Possibly that, plus the fact that that she was pretty well fixed financially herself and she was independent that way. She could do what she darn well pleased. And I think that's at a period of male and female. You get to the 40s or whatever it is and everybody gets a little bit sidetracked according to most books, anyhow.
I read passages too.
No, but I think that's sort of an established fact today.
Well, then, your mother was financially independent, and she was an independent type woman, intelligent and gritty.
She was a super woman, highly educated, well-to-do, and had a beautiful home, and wonderful friends, and wonderful connections, and a very exciting life, and loved it.
Yeah, but she just decided that. She wanted to.
I don't know.
Be on her own.
I don't know. We didn't discuss that.
She really left the house to him and went to Florida. After
you know what the circumstances were? Why she left the house to him?
Well, it was probably a cleaner, simpler way to do it. And in those days, people didn't make a big issue about divorce settlements and all that sort of thing like they do today. They don't grind each other down and all that sort of thing. And I think it must have been a fairly friendly thing. An arrangement.
Well, she went to Reno.
Well, I think she had to go to Reno to get the divorce.
And I thought you had gone, but I guess George went with her.
George may have gone. I didn't.
I just wondered if now see, you're out more or less on your own, independent. You've already been published, well on your way, established as a human being, we'll put it this way. And George, of course, was still a young child, still under his mother's wing, so to speak.
Right.
And
I was definitely on my own by then.
But you were still living at Rye.
Yeah, but I mean, I was my own guy. I had my own future. I had all sorts of ideas of being another Roy Chapman Andrews or that type of thing. And when I quit that type of life to get married, I had offers of 6 other expeditions to go elsewhere in the world with people I didn't even know. So I was all set to go on, and I don't say I made the mistake, but I fell in love and got married, and when I did that, I had to settle down.
Now, when...
And that's when my grandfather died. I was in 34.
That's when you were married.
I was married in 32.
32.
Mm-hmm. But when my grandfather died, I was the oldest grandchild, and the executor of the estate wanted somebody in Florida that they could trust to be the spokesman and at least relay problems back correctly that they could believe. So they asked me to take a leave of absence of 1 year and come to Florida. And I went to work at the pre-cooling plant in Fort Pierce, which was part of my grandfather's estate. He died on the way down to see the opening of it, incidentally.
The opening of the
pre-cooling plant. It was a marine seaport citrus operation.
Now, this was in 34.
Yeah.
You were taking a year's leave of absence from?
Northeast, what is now Northeast? Boston Main Airways.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started right in with Amelia and Vidal and Solomon and everything.
Right.
In the original organization.
Right.
Of
I was one of the six stockholders.
All right, I think we just about finished with that very unpleasant part of the thing, which isn't really terribly important except to give some insight into the
Well, in spite of the divorces and marriages and all that, they both had a very exciting, fine, friendly life.
Did they see very much of each other after they got divorced?
I would say practically not at all.
Not at all.
Right. When my mother came to Florida, that's when she married Frank Upton. And they built a beautiful home, or she built a beautiful home in Florida. Then they were married, and my grandfather set Frank Upton, the sea captain, up as a president of the bank, which he controlled at Fort Pierce. That didn't last very long.
Do you remember when you were married? Were they married in 29?
That's probably bad.
Yeah.
It's a matter of record, obviously. No, I don't remember.
Okay. Back to Media. She didn't stay at Rye. As a matter of fact, she took an apartment in town, in New York, Manhattan. And she was an eligible young lady.
Prior to the marriage, I mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she was... dating Loining at that time,
uh-huh.
Wilbur Loining, and they were flying down to Maryland to the races and things uh-huh. like this, and having dinner parties at various uh-huh. people's houses and whatnot, and she took on a job as aviation editor for Cosmopolitan magazine, uh-huh. which is a completely different Cosmopolitan in those days than it is now. And she wrote a series of articles, and that lasted for about 9 or 10 months, or well, almost a year. And then, I believe, from there, she went to work for the Ludington Line.
Yes.
Did you ever see Amelia during these periods of time?
Oh, yeah, all the time, regularly. Ludington Line was started by Sam Solomon. That was between Washington and New York. It was every hour on the hour. I remember that very well. Was a shuttle, the equivalent of our modern shuttle.
Now, how were you seeing Amelia between the end of 1928 and the start of the Ludington Line in 1929?
With Sam and my dad and the promotion on the future stuff, and I guess Dad was seeing her a lot more than I did. I can't put those pieces together right now. But I would say that we saw her quite often.
Was she a guest at Rye during a period of time very often?
I don't remember. I remember they had an apartment at the, I've forgotten the hotel. I didn't say the Algonquin. It wasn't the Algonquin. They had an apartment a block or two above the Algonquin in one of those little resort hotel places.
Parkley?
No, doesn't make any difference.
Okay.
Anyhow, they had an apartment in New York for some time, but this was after they were married. During it, from the divorce to the, from mother and dad's divorce to dad's marriage, I draw a blank on putting the pieces together. I can't tell you.
Were you gone most of that time? That would have been when you were...
Well, when I was 18, I took my own expedition to the Arctic. On the Jehala, so I was gone for a good slug of the period of time, and of course I was still trying to stay in school occasionally. So I really didn't see a hell of a lot of them. I was either on the expeditions, I was also on the LeVar Brazilian Guiana expedition during that period.
So you were gone most of that?
Yeah. I was either on an expedition or in school.
So you were 16, 17, and 18 then. Now, something very traumatic happened to everybody. We had what we called Black Friday in 1929, and the whole character of American business changed practically overnight.
It sure did.
And
that broke my dad.
Now, your father was quite successful, but the publishing business was not the sort of business that you were very vulnerable, I guess, to.
Well, it wasn't that so much. There were two crashes, as you recall, and on the first one he pulled through, and then he loaned a substantial amount of money to a cousin. And then the second crash came along and he couldn't cover, so Dad was wiped out and so was the cousin, so he never recouped that one either.
Well, that's why your dad ended up having to sell the publishing
company. Right. Well, I don't think that that's the reason he had to sell it. It may have been part of it, contributing factor to it. But the publishing business during the Depression, of course, was a pretty dead duck anyhow. And at that time, he went with Paramount as head of their New York office. On picking books for pictures and that type of thing. And he headed up the New York office for Paramount for some time, and then they moved to California and built out there as a result of that connection.
All right, now, one thing I want to ask you.
Getting back to the Depression, though, something that has nothing to do with the media, but I worked for the World Telegram as a writer, as an investigator, and came up with all sorts of interesting stuff. I had several full-page articles in there. World Telegram at that time. During the height of the Depression, I stood in the red lines, and I was a professional beggar in New York and all that for a long time, which is very interesting.
In 1931, when your father and Amelia were married, I put two and two together and got eight in this particular case. Anyway, they were married.
They were married in 31.
Yeah, February.
We went to California in 32.
Six or something like that. I can't remember the exact date of their marriage, just offhand. I think February 7th. And then your father, within a week, transferred G.P. Putnam's sons to, and son to, I can't remember exactly who it was transferred to.
Earl Balch was one of them.
But the point I was trying to make was there was no connection between his marrying Amelia and having to divest himself to the publishing company. That was just a coincidence.
I think so, but I'm not sure of that because I don't know.
Because I know that your mother had access to monies that your father didn't have.
Right.
Separate source, we'll say. And your father was independently wealthy up until as the publishing company prospered, so did he prosper. Mm-hmm. But when the publishing company did not prosper, he did not prosper too. I did not know anything about him loaning money to your cousin. And I just wondered if Dorothy, when he married Amelia, might have got angry and pulled the rug out from underneath him, and that's what caused him to...
If she did, I don't know about it.
I just wonder, you know, it was a coincidence of the time that he mm-hmm. married her, and then within a week he had to divest his interest in the publishing company.
Well, it may have had some bearing on it because she controlled her side of the purse strings.
I just wonder, now, they were married. Your father had asked Amelia to marry her a few times,
mm-hmm.
and...
She didn't want to get married. And I think he really talked her into it.
Who was the fellow in Connecticut or wherever that Amelia was supposed to be dating for so long
ago? Oh, that was way Chapman fellow. So
that was way earlier. Yeah,
way earlier. Okay, shall we?
Yeah, I think we better. It's a nice place.
Glad we're through with all that stuff. Uh-huh. Now we can get into where the No, the only reason it has any bearing is to give me some insight into the father's way of thinking,
mm-hmm.
and so that I can try and think like he thinks.
Well, I think the answer to that, from my point of view, is if he'd had anything, it would have all gone to peg, and he probably would have given us boys something. But I knew before he died that he was in bad financial straits, and he knew that I knew it. And the way he and Peg lived, they both realized it and knew that there was no cover-up, and he wasn't pretending to be something he wasn't.
Now, I want you not to misunderstand something. What we're talking about, it has no part in anything.
No, I realize that. I realize.
All I'm interested in is to understand the character,
even
how the man...
Even until the day he died, he was still a dreamer. He still had big ideas, and he had all these ideas about Death Valley, which he wrote about. Last 2 books.
Well, of course, don't forget, all of his life was done on his the Oregonian part that you recall to me of what he did out there. Mm-hmm. Proof of the kind of a guy he was. And they were all successful, not necessarily financially, but what you just termed a dream isn't a dream if he can follow through it, and he did, and he did that all his life. I've seen books hatched at the table, which were just his ideas. Bill Robinson was having dinner with us in Rye one night, and I started talking about small boat sailing. And out of that one dinner came 20,000 Leagues Over the Sea by William Robinson. Hmm. And he was that kind of a guy.
And he continued to be that way all his life.
Yeah, yeah. No, but your term dreamer, I think, doesn't fit him. He wasn't a dreamer. He was a hell of an idea man. And I think there's a lot of difference. Yeah. To me, a dreamer is somebody who's dreaming of something that is probably impossible. An idea man, he's going to hit a certain percentage of them, whether it's
maybe
financial.
Maybe that comes from my interpretation of what I consider Elton a dreamer about, that he does.
Well, I have friends when I talk to them about some of my ventures, and they say, well, that's just all pie in the sky. And I won't tell you what I told them, but I said, no, it's not pie in the sky. It seems impossible to you, but it doesn't seem impossible to me for the following reasons, the connections and this and this and that. Then the money market goes to hell or something, and it all falls flat. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean it was a dream.
Doesn't necessarily mean it was a bad idea.
I had a $200 million project in Fort Pierce, and it wasn't dreaming. I had it all out on paper. I had it all financed. Then the money market went to hell. I had two underwritings go down the drain, and the motion picture business went down the drain at the same time, and I was involved in the motion pictures, and I was going to finance part of my development with the profits from motion pictures that I was producing. Well, they all went to hell at the same time. I lost the whole thing, and it's now a park. And I sold it for 20 cents on the dollar.
Your father became very involved about the latter part of 1934 in helping the movie with Hurwitz. And really, it's kind of remarkable that a man could...
Well, I was
be
one.
Supportive enough of his wife to allow her to do these things, go out and do things that other men just wouldn't allow their wives, think of allowing their wives to do, and not only allow her to do them, but devote most of his time to supporting her.
Well, he was supporting her, but not with an ulterior motive, but under the circumstances, he was probably also getting back on his feet by helping her. He was doing things that were going to produce books or lecture tours or something else in which he would get back on his feet. So I don't think he was breaking his back just to help her. I think it was a combination thing. They were working together, let's say, on projects.
Well, he did an awful lot of work. And now, they had an office in New York on West...
42nd Street.
42nd. And... he had a secretary.
Joe Berger. Greatest office secretary I ever saw in my life. Fantastic woman. I never will forget little Joe Berger.
Can you tell me any little things about Joe?
About Joe? Mm-hmm. Well, she was devoted to him. She was a fantastically capable gal. Dad's memory was sort of like mine. I can never quite put my finger on things. He'd walk in and say, who is that fellow you know who's connected with so-and-so in Chicago? And she would say, oh, you mean Harry Schultz? And he would just tell her what he wanted, and she would write him a letter or get him on the phone, just like that. She was his right arm. She was with him in Paramount office also. Joe died a few years back.
Yes, she actually died in the mid-40s of cancer.
Yeah, a long time ago. No, she was just a very, very capable, devoted, professional secretary.
Now you, I just can't remember what your father and Amelia were doing in the West Coast in 32.
I don't remember the years. That's my problem. I can't differentiate between 32 and 36 or...
Because this is...
31.
This is when, you know, Boston and Maine was just going good.
Well, then the California thing must have been later. Later than when I'm thinking.
They didn't actually build the house until 36 in Toluca Lake.
Well, then I'm 3 or 4 years off on my timing. I say I don't remember the years at all.
Did you visit him at the house in
Toluca
Lake?
Oh, yes.
Do you, now, they had another secretary now out.
They had a male secretary then, I think, didn't they?
Pardon?
I think they had a male secretary then.
No, it was a woman.
I don't remember the secretary. I remember a marvelous Filipino houseboy. I don't remember the secretary.
You remember the Filipino houseboy's name?
No, but he was a gem. He was a cook and a chauffeur and a gardener and a companion. He was just a fantastic human being. Even if you mention his name, I don't know that I'd remember it. I can see him, but I can't think of his name.
Did he happen?
Seems to me it's Fred. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if Fred was his name. But that's was such an
Fred?
Unusual name for
I know it, but was it Fred?
Rico or something.
Was it Fred?
I don't really know. I've never been able to locate
that just, it. That just came out.
I think it was Fred.
I believe it was. It must have been, or it wouldn't have come to me that way.
But we've never been able to locate it before. Find out his full name, so we could
locate it. There's even newspaper articles that were written about him, after his disappearance.
Well, he was really an exception.
But they never mentioned his name. They just call him the Filipino houseboy.
Exceptional human being.
Do you remember a red cockatoo or something like that, or some sort of a bird around the house?
No.
Must come later. I just wondered maybe if you brought that back from the gun or something.
No.
They had a cockatoo that roamed around the house there for a while. Fred spent half his life going up on the roof and getting it.
Was that at the house, or was that up at place at Lone Pine? Whitney, yeah, Lone Pine.
Whitney Portal.
Whitney Portal.
I believe it was at the house, but
I'm not sure. A bird somewhere comes in, but I associate it with the Whitney Portal.
You remember Jean Marie? Did you ever meet her at all in Sydney?
Oh yes. Oh, yeah, sure. Dad and I went with Jean to the World's Fair in New York together.
I haven't met her.
Well, haven't you met me?
No.
Who was
that?
No, I met you at the
World's
Fair.
That was his third time.
Didn't last very long.
Oh, okay.
She was a darling.
She, by the way, is still alive. She lives in near San Diego now.
Okay.
Not for the tape, but I think she was a little bit off a rocker later or something.
I don't know. She's a lovely couture woman.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, she was a gorgeous, lovely gal, and she was just—I just fell in love with her. She was so cute and kind to me. I have a picture of Jean and me sitting on either a no parking or keep off the grass sign at the World's Fair in New York. I can remember that very well. She was.
What happened to that relationship there?
It just went down the drain in a quick hurry. I don't know.
Well, didn't that happen when your father went into service? Isn't that when they got
divorced? He was very insistent on going into service. That's quite a tale in itself. I don't know whether you know the inside of that.
No, I don't.
No,
it could be, and I never thought of this until you brought it up, because I never knew the reason that they broke up. I understood that she kind of went off a rocker. Not from my dad, but from other people, that she had a mental problem or something. I don't think it was drinking, so I won't say alcoholism or something like that. But it could be that she was so demanding that she didn't want him to go into the service and said it was ridiculous at his age. And when he did anyhow, that could have been, it could have been that simple a thing.
He was well along when he went into the service.
They offered him a full colonelship or generalship to go in the Pentagon and go into intelligence or something like that. And he told me, he said, if I go into the thing, I want to go into it as a man and not just as an ex-publisher with some brains. So he turned down the appointment in the Pentagon assignment and went to ROTC in Miami Beach with all those kids. And at the time, curiously enough, I was flying for Pan American and based in Coral Gables. So I got to see him every once in a while. But he was out there with all those kids running and marching and going to classes, and he came out as a captain. And he was so proud of it, and I have, someplace I have a picture of my dad with his new captain's bars, and I was a pilot for Pan American.
You
had Benny showed it to you, I guess. Mm-hmm. She must have it in her scrapbook and.
I think it's among your things, honey. I think it's probably out in storage. Not that it makes any difference. But
anyhow, that was something that I hadn't thought of in a long time. I was in Miami Beach as a Pan American pilot for Pan American Air Ferries on a military contract when he was going to through school with teenagers and young 20-year-olds. He came out as a captain. And then he ended up as the intelligence officer for Curtis LeMay's B-29 outfit. Did you know that? And my last visit with my dad in this country during the war, I was operations officer. I think at that time I was a captain in Great Falls, Montana. And I personally picked out a lot of the B-29 crews to go on the Hiroshima B-29 mission. And at that time, LeMay was a colonel. I was delivering a B-17 from Great Falls, Montana to, I don't know, Savannah, Georgia or someplace. My co-pilot was Bob Crawford, who wrote the Air Corps song. Mm-hmm. Off we go in the wild blue yonder. Mm-hmm. And I have a picture of Bob in that same B-17. The B-29 project with LeMay, of course, was terribly, terribly top secret. Nobody even knew where they were based or where they were training or anything else. But in my outfit, we picked out our best 29 pilots to go to them, and ATC furnished a lot of their best four-engine pilots to go for training in B-29 with LeMay. And Dad got special permission, very secretively, for me to come and visit them before they left. And Bob Crawford and I flew to wherever it was, Salina, Kansas, or wherever they had this place, and spent 2 days there with LeMay and all that crew. And that was the last time I saw my dad before he went overseas. Which I think is, but for him to do that at that age, anyhow, he was LeMay's intelligence officer in China. And in China is where he picked up a hell of a bug. He wasn't in on the Hiroshima deal, but he was in on everything prior to it. And he had to be shipped home, and they diagnosed his problem as cirrhosis of the liver, which it probably was not. It was probably some sort of a wild
virus.
Yeah. Anyhow, that's supposed to be what killed him. He came home, and I have pictures of me and my dad at the Whitney Portal Pass place and Death Valley. No, he wasn't there then. This was Whitney Portal. And I went and visited him, got a few days off, went to California and visited him. He was in civilian clothes then, and I was in uniform. And he got very sick after I came back east. And I talked to him on the phone a few times, but they called and said he was dying and come out, and I missed him and didn't get there in time.
What did he die of?
They said cirrhosis of the liver.
Which is the same diagnosis of the kind of thing.
well, cirrhosis of the liver today usually means alcoholism or something like that. He didn't drink.
He did not know.
He didn't drink. No, he never did. He very seldom take a drink, even in a cocktail party.
Did he smoke?
No. He
couldn't
no.
very well smoke and drink and be married to a Christian scientist. That's what Jean Marie was.
Well, no, he didn't do any of that stuff. He had a pretty bad tummy. But he was a hell of an outdoorsman. He was a great fly fisherman. He was a wonderful shot with a revolver, and he was a great horseback rider and mountain climber and all that stuff.
Were you in Fort Pierce then during most of the preparations for the flight? When do you remember when you went to Fort Pierce?
Fort Pierce? I went to Fort Pierce in '34. Okay.
In when the preparations for the flight, did you ever fly with Amelia in the Lockheed 10 at all?
No, not in the 10.
In the Vega.
In the Vega, I flew with her in the Vega. I never flew with her in the 10. But I helped when it was in Florida. I helped her load it and did a lot of fiddling around. That's when we went to the Pan American hangars and discussed radio problems and that sort of thing, and where I think Fred Noonan was with us at the time.
Okay, now we'll go back then. Do you remember? Okay, Amelia was coming with your dad and Bo McNeely and Noonan. They were all in the airplane. They started from Burbank and they flew out. They went up to Oakland, came back to Burbank, or at least Amelia did, and then came back to Burbank. Then they went to Tucson, then New Orleans, and El Paso, then New Orleans, and finally on in.
Ended up in Miami.
Miami. Were you at Miami at the time that she arrived?
I don't remember whether I was there the day she arrived, but I was down there most of the time that she was in Miami.
Okay, I want to ask you a question. The press left it all up in the air. She landed at the wrong airport in Miami and made a very bad landing and took off again immediately and went over to the right airport and landed there. Did you ever hear why she landed at the wrong airport?
No. I remember hearing something about it, but I don't recall any of the reasons or what happened. I can't even think of the name of the airport that she left from. It's now
36th Street.
No, it wasn't 36th Street. It's just north of 36th Street.
Okay, I.
It had a separate name.
Hialeah.
No, it's there are two. There are two in that area. I'll think of it. It's no longer an airport.
Okay, while she was there, as they came across the country...
Excuse me, a lot of our Pan American training was done out of that same field when I was training with Pan American.
Okay,
I can show you exactly where
it is. It's a matter of record.
I just don't
have to know my own idea. During that period of time, and she was in Miami about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you were down there.
I was there most of that time.
And must have been kind of nice being with your father.
Oh, it was very exciting. Well, not just being with them, but the whole project was pretty exciting for me.
As she came across the country, she was having all sorts of trouble with her radio. Her transmitter just wasn't getting out. Now, Joe Gurr, back at United Airlines, at the United Terminal, but he worked for United Airlines. He didn't work for Manson. He didn't work for Lockheed. He worked for United Airlines. But he moonlighted. Paul Mance inquired around, Amelia inquired around, we need some this radio, this thing, right? And who's a good radio man? Well, the best man we know is just Joe Gurr, who works for United. So he came over and he spent a lot of time working on the airplane. And one of the things she was complaining about was a trailing wire antenna. And Joe said, well, for long-range communication, that's the way you're only going to be, that's the only way you're going to be able to get out on that lower frequency. You got to get a long antenna out there. He said, now I can make you up a little loading coil, and we can put it between the transmitter and the antenna, and for short range, maybe you can get out on 500 kcs with this, but it's just loading this little flat top antenna, and it isn't going to be of much use, but maybe close in you could use it. Sounds good. So Joe made up this loading coil, and I actually have pictures showing it in the airplane, how it was set up and everything. And I have a photograph, Joe Gurr has a photograph, which I made copies of, which says 500.
Was that the coil wind in thing. Aerial?
No, that's the trailing wire. Mm-hmm. This was a loading coil,
yeah.
So she could use that little flat top.
Right.
And of course, you know how much radiation that'd be lucky to get a quarter of a watt out of it, but close in, it might have given out a signal on 500. However, this was done between March, when the airplane, or I should say April, when the airplane was returned to Lockheed for major repairs after the Luke crash, and the time she took off the first part of June for the
mm-hmm.
trip. I'm sorry, latter part of May. And when she was going across country with this thing, she wasn't getting out on 3105 and 6210 like she used to. And, of course, he'd been fiddling with the antenna. And so when she got to Miami, she says, hey, this ain't going to work because I'm just not putting out on 3105 and 6210 like I'm supposed to. In other words, he started fiddling with the antenna, and it's
the technical part I can't recall at all. I didn't know much about it either, but I do know that we spent, I would say, 2 or 3 days at least with Pan American's radio shop people. And I think Noonan was in on some of those meetings. But I do remember going to Pan American's top people and being taken to their shops, and Amelia was discussing in detail the technical difficulties or whatever her version of it was. Beyond that, I'll jog your memory
a little bit. The guy that was the head of the radio shop at the time was a guy by the name of Pettijohn. Such an unusual name,
it rings a bell, but that's all.
But unfortunately, Pan American was right in the process of installing a whole bunch of new equipment on all their airplanes.
They were awfully busy, but they did apparently try to help her as much as possible.
So he assigned another fellow who was very knowledgeable about different kinds of equipment and whatnot, and had a lot of technical background, but had really just started for Pan American and was not much help on the installation. And anyway, so he assigned them to go over to the, because they were down at Dinner Key,
mm-hmm.
to go up to where everybody was and work on her problems. And unfortunately, Pettijohn, who's still alive and good sound minds, still lives down in Coral Gables, didn't get involved in it. He assigned this other guy, and unfortunately the other guy died a few years later. And Pettijohn doesn't really know what he did,
mm-hmm.
except that they kept trying to get the antenna to work right. And it's obvious from the photographs and whatnot, and many other reasons, that they decided that the trailing wire antenna was just causing problems. They neither one of them knew how to use code anyway, and it had to go in the back to reel out the antenna, and go in the back to reel it in. It was just more trouble than it was worth. It was additional weight. So they took the trailing wire off, and this is from the photographs. You can see it was on when the airplane mm-hmm. came into Miami, and from then on, it's never on again. So the trailing wire was removed. The point is, they kept working on the antenna length and trying to get the transmitter to put out right. In the process, I wonder, did they take out that loading coil too?
I don't have any idea.
I don't either. Okay.
I was not with them at the airplane when they were working on the radio. I was with them at Pan American shops during those discussions. So I have no recollection of what they took out or put into the airplane itself.
So they kept working on this antenna until they finally got it, and then they go up and test fly the airplane. They were also having rudder troubles with the autopilot. And they would test fly the autopilot and test fly the antenna and go up and work the radio. And and at the same time, they were also running up the section lines and whatnot, working on the compass.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember anything about that?
Vaguely. I mean, I knew they were doing some compass checking, but
okay. The final upshot of it all was, after 5 or 6 days, that they had the 3105 and 6210 were working pretty good now, putting out The training wire was removed. The autopilot was working satisfactorily. And the compass was as accurate as any compass could expect be expected to be. Everything seemed preparation for the flight. Now, two or three other things come in here. To your knowledge, I do know that a bunch of radio spare parts were sent from the Bendix factory to Miami in June of 37. What they were, whether they ever arrived or anything. And I just wonder, is it possible that they changed the transmitter to a Bendix transmitter
in Miami?
In Miami.
I wouldn't know.